Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Wait, what? I must have taken a wrong turn. I'm not on the road or on a ship or in some islands. I'm actually here in studio.
Yeah, it's weird. It's been so long.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo. It's Hi. The trio, the original trio. We're here.
That's it. That's a Weird Things classic.
As it always has been.
Yeah. Gentlemen, I'm glad that some of us are here in some shape or form. You know, it's like we're like Voltron, but we can take many different forms.
Yeah, we're a modular mech, right? Some days you can just do it with the legs. Some days you can do it with the arms.
I would like to imagine there's a debate where they're like form Voltron. They're like, there's only four of us. It's like, well, go without a leg. We're like, well, we kind of need the leg. There's gravity on this planet. All right, fine, lose an arm. Have we tried it without the head? No, that's insane. You know, how are we gonna do this?
Phil called in sick.
Yeah.
I feel like the left arm would be the least important because it's always a one arm sword, right?
But also that's where you get the shield forms from, and
it's a difficult debate.
You know, you could probably bail on both legs. They probably could be like a floating upper torso.
That torso's got to have rockets or something.
Yeah, right.
You would imagine. A lot of that, you know.
I will give a quick plug. If you've not watched the Netflix version of Voltron, they do a really good job of making a context where I don't know, you care about a kung fu robot battle in space. And yes, they can do anything. Like, they keep surprising you with, like, you know, form chainmail, magic chainmail. It's all magic, and there's no real consistent set of rules. But the storytelling is so exquisite that I don't mind it. I love it.
Yeah. Well, that's a future we can look forward to. I'm sure that, you know, DARPA's working on Voltron somewhere. I texted Brian before the show because I wanted to talk about a topic. But first, let me just point this out. Over the weekend, Tesla, hear the news?
Mm-mm. Yes, I did.
5,000 Model 3s in a week. That was their deadline. They wanted to try to be able to hit a run rate of making 5,000 Tesla Model 3s in a week. And they did that actually in 1 week and 4 hours or something. So.
Yeah, didn't Elon Musk tweet that it was like 7,000 in 7 days?
7,000 Teslas total. So that's Model 3s, Model X's, and Model S's.
I really want to believe that it looked exactly like the Michael Keaton movie Gung Ho, where everybody's taking their ties and wrapping them around their like headbands. And
you know that movie was based upon the premise of the Muni plant where Tesla is at now.
No kidding.
This is this big Japanese American cooperative plant. That's what I understand is that because that when they built that plant, because it was a Toyota plant, that was the whole, you know, plan. So,
very cool.
Or that was sort of what the inspiration was. I'm told I'm gonna look this up right now so I don't make a complete idiot of myself. But yeah, I want to. They're all doing calisthenics together. You know.
And these are
Elon Musk. You know, he makes a mistake of telling the of overpromising to his union. I don't think there is a union there.
But then
the Japanese investors are like, this one does not count.
And the Numi plant, jointly owned by General Motors and Toyota, opened in 1984. I call it the Muni plant. The Numi plant.
Muni plant.
The Muni plant.
Well, then
they do mass weddings there.
Didn't Toshiba come out and say, oh, man, like they picked up the rate, and so we're going to be crunched on – I'm sorry?
Panasonic.
And said we're going to be crunched on battery supplies because they're starting to pick up speed.
Yeah, that's the thing is that, like, inside each one of those is like – They're making their own batteries, but like 2,000 batteries the size of like a laptop battery. So like they're becoming like the biggest battery producer in the world. So be interested to see. So it's kind of neat. You know, this was the backstory in that why kind of a weird things tech thing is that originally Elon Musk had envisioned this super futuristic high-tech factory with robots, you know, moving at dizzying speeds, which they do. And he had to. And I think it's an example of like, yes, great idea. A lot of kinks need to be worked out first before we get to that full on realized factory of the future. And he said as much, but they would be doing things like they'd bring in these robots that were, you know, building stuff and they would pull some off the line and they would try to overclock them because they knew what they were rated for by the manufacturer. But they're like, how much faster can we make this thing go?
That's wild. I wouldn't have thought in terms of overclocking, because obviously some amount of motion, if you just speed up the motion, make it cartoon fast, obviously you end up making stuff faster.
But you'd think for an industrial robot that it would be rated for like long-term safety, you know, without overclocking. I mean,
yeah, but I'm
sure there's a trade-off in either maintenance or reliability, but...
Yeah, I would imagine also, though, that everything as it comes off the production line, you know, let's say it's a 37 spot welds, right? And it's like it's able to do it in 15 minutes normally. If you overclock it, you know, and let's say it does it in 10 minutes, maybe that affects the tolerance of safety, which I guess you could find out. As it comes off the line, you're able to say like, oh, no, one out of every 200 rivets is slightly off.
Well, I mean, for the long-term health of those machines, those arms.
Right. You know, and servers, that's the other side of the thing, too. Yeah.
So you have, you know, you think about it, though. So, of course, you've got, you know, Tesla engineers and SpaceX engineers and these people looking at these machines going, oh, this is the best you can do? Are you sure? We've heard that before. And you could go take this thing apart and you might find it could even be not that there's a physical limit, but maybe, oh, we can optimize the machine code that runs this thing and we can make this thing work 4% faster. A 4% faster robotic arm is a 4% increase in, you know, roughly speaking, you know, sure, in what it's able to output.
Well, and I can picture like, let's say a robotic arm does the first of 72 functions. It does like seven of them and then it pauses to queue up the next set of seven moves or whatever. Might be the kind of thing that you could spend, you know, I'm making all of this up, but, you know, spend a bit on extra processing power to save that valuable time. Because this is something we've talked about, Elon Musk, before. He does get dinged, but only on delivering when he promises. It's he turns in great homework usually. It's just a little bit late, so you have to give minus 7 points on there.
Yeah, it's that, you know, wow, he's a year late from doing this. It's like, yeah, but we've got robot fast, amazing electric cars probably 5 years ahead of time when we thought we would have got them. You know, yeah, he was late in when his delivering on this. But if he starts delivering realistic delivery dates, I'm worried. I don't want him to deliver realistic delivery dates, because then he's like, man, maybe I'm going too fast, you know, and it took a special kind of person and team and group of people working there at Tesla to make this thing happen. You know, and we're going to hear horror stories too about, you know, workers and conditions and things like this. I'm sure we're going to hear this, you know, whether or not it's outsized for a company that size, whatever, but, you know, trying to work that fast, you know, is not without consequences there, but I mean, it's what's within the realm of what's you need to be done. So,
yeah, it'll be interesting to see if this rate holds next week and the week after that, and, you know,
yeah,
for going further, you know, if they're at the point where they're having to overclock machines or something, that may not be a sustainable rate at the moment, but that's something that comes over time.
Yeah. And he says they're going to try to hit 6,000 per week by the end of this month. So that was what happened is they had, you know, like stock, you know, the stock market, I looked, you know, yesterday hit this. I'm like, I was talking to a friend. I'm like, well, it's going to be interesting. It's like the first day or so, it's hard to predict either way, because people might say, we already built this into the price. The before market trading, it went up like 3%, 4%. And then once it opened, the stock actually went down. It's now down like 1%. I watched it go down like 3 or 4%, and then I just bought a bunch because I'm like, I know where this is good. I know how this story plays out. You know, I've been following this. So
yeah, that's not that I'm giving financial advice, but that's one of the greatest reframes that I really enjoyed is among the wealthy, when stocks, quote unquote, tank or crash or whatever, they see it very differently. They say, oh, they're having a sale on businesses. Well, what businesses did I want to load up on that previously seemed too expensive for me?
Do you remember, if you go to the biggest trough they had in like the last 2 years, I sent a couple people here a text message.
In fact, yeah, you were just like, hey, FYI, guess what's cheap right now?
Yeah. I do not give professional financial advice whatsoever. You know, I'm a cruise ship magician. Just take it from that.
Hey, speaking of which, can we take a moment to talk about the nature of cruise ships? Because I had never been on one.
And please.
It was fascinating to as a touring magician, you know, you tend to think logistics. You tend to think like, okay, what is physically waist high that I could use as a device to set this particular prop on? And then, you know, and as a result, you know, because you only have 15 minutes to set up for the gig, next thing you know, you've emptied out a trash can, you flipped it upside down, you laid a tablecloth over it, and it looks presentable, and it's on there on stage next to you. So one of my favorite things is just figuring out all the logistics in the background. And how much it reminded me of what I see when I go to a Disneyland or a Disney World, where it's like, you know, they begin with the ending in mind. And even the fact that when you get on the boat, you don't really think about the fact of everybody getting off the boat until it's your turn to get off the boat. And you realize, oh, they're doing a massive turnaround of we'll say, 600 different hotel rooms in a 7-hour period. As this giant floating shopping mall goes, I don't know. It's really, really fascinating. And I would love to hear, because I assume since working on them, did you ever get a chance to see more of the behind the scenes logistics of all that? Oh, or?
Yeah. I mean, so I started working on ships when I was a teenager, right? And so I started at a point when the industry hadn't changed a lot that much in several decades. All that really happened was you had Carnival came in and started consolidating because Carnival figured out a lot of efficiencies. And because they're slightly more efficient than other people, they could go out there and they started buying up other cruise lines. And Carnival became one of the biggest cruise lines, the biggest cruise line in the world. And then, you know, a few years into me working on them, they started building the mega ships. They started dramatically increasing the size of these ships. And that was interesting because, and then I'd perform on them, or I'd have friends that would like, hey, I got to go put a show in. Can you help produce and come, you know, make sure that everything runs tight, whatever. And I remember it was like Carnival Dream or one of the first big humongous ships. And I'd point it out to a friend of mine because it was ported to Miami. Like, you know, the largest theater in all of Miami is actually on board this cruise ship.
Wow.
You know, because it was bigger than whatever the current, like, you know, they had like Night Center and stuff. The largest actual, you know, regular standard theater was like this. So you look at how there's the layer where people get on board, off board. You think they got thousands of people on board the ship have to get on and off. There's the entire managed crew. When you go below quarters and you realize, you know, there's, you know, sometimes there's like, you know, crew person per every person work on the ship or something like this. I mean, like there's the number of crew there, how the crew is stacked up in the below decks quarters is kind of amazing because there's an entirely different story about what goes on there. A lot of people from the Philippines and where other countries were hired from, you know, it's very interesting, like the dynamics of that. But then also, like when the ship is in port, you see you're getting on and off, but you look down, you see the forklifts moving the massive amounts of food and everything that it takes back and forth. And you realize like, oh, yeah, like, you know, this is it's a city. It's a floating city that gets replenished every time it's constantly being replenished.
So for me, what I was struck with is I guess I haven't just ridden very many boats. You know, there have been plenty of times I've gotten on a vessel and we go out and we tootle around and stuff. But that moment of being out on a vessel and looking out, not seeing land in any direction really puts into context how the early pioneers, the early people riding in those Spanish galleons or whatever, they were straight up spaceships. There was nothing outside. If you step, just like today, if you step outside of that capsule, you're a dead man. There's nobody that's going to get you and there's nothing to sustain your life there. That already has been the case for thousands of years, And I guess that was one of the I don't want to say a wake-up call, but that was a great moment for me to realize that so many of the things that seem exotic about space travel are already very familiar in the history of humankind.
We've been, as we pushed out of the cradle of, you know, humanity and we moved further north, we started building spacesuits by using animal skins, you know, like arguably what those things are. We started figuring out how to build habitats that we could survive the night through when it got too cold, you know, building our ships and sustainability. We've been solving these problems for thousands of years. And there's no reason that we all of a sudden are going to get dumb and aren't going to be able to solve them anymore. But the point about being far away, I hypothetically imagine being in a just a large raft. Hours and hours, there was no land in sight in shark-infested waters, barreling through the night, trying to avoid reefs and other things because one of those could rip apart your entire vehicle hurrying back.
Harrowing.
Yeah. Seems like.
Imagine this... that a couple nights in a row. Just saying. Because you're in some exotic location and it's not.
Unrelatedly, is there any news about any projects that you've been working on that you're able to share?
No news yet.
Okay.
No news.
Well,
I do have an appearance coming up on Cash Cab where I'm being featured as a Discovery Channel Shark Week host. So.
Wow. I love the fact that you can only report what other people have reported.
Yeah. So I like that. I like, you know, we'll see.
Man, TV is a nutty business. Yeah. I mean, assuming you're on TV.
Maybe. I'm going to be in WesterCon, by the way. This conference in big science fiction fantasy convention going on in Denver this weekend. So I'm going to be at WesterCon. I'm actually doing a Q&A with David Gerald, the guy who wrote The Trouble Tribbles. So
no kidding.
Yeah.
How cool is that?
Yeah, look up WesterCon. I'll be a guest there, so check that out. Myths and Legends.
Yeah, malcondenver.org. Very cool. Yeah. July 4th through the 8th.
So how do you think they're going to introduce you? Because that's one of the things that – and maybe this is more of an after things discussion, but it's like I find it increasingly challenging when people say, what do you do? The first words out of my mouth are, well, for 20 years I toured as a magician. And then like I'm like, why is that part of the story at all? You know, it's like that's not what I'm doing today right now, although I still do kind of do that at least, you know, once or twice a month. How do you introduce yourself?
It's funny because I had to put together a bio, right? And I know I got booked because they said, oh, we want to have somebody like a different offbeat TV personality sort of person. So I was there because I did, you know, my TV magic show and all that. And then I had to write my bio. And I'm like, well, what happened this year? Okay, Wall Street Journal bestseller, Edgar nomination. And so I'm like, wow, I'm a literary guy by all the recent stuff there. And I thought that was kind of funny because it was like, you know, like I know they booked me because, oh, you know, we had a friend that helped organize the conference. And do you want to do this? I'm like, yeah, sure. And so and then, you know, conferences, I forgot about it. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, I got to do this thing. But that's yeah, it's like, how do I'd rather push the writer thing now, but whatever.
Yeah.
So I wanted to have a conversation about a couple topics relating to the future of money. We've talked about this before because these things come up again. And I do not have strongly held positions on these things. Let me make it very clear. I have, what about this? What about this? You know, I hear this, but we haven't thought about this or whatever. And one of them is minimum basic income. We've talked about this before, and it's come up. It keeps rearing its head again because, you know, we have this accelerating economy in the sense of, like, right now, economy's turned around. It's doing really good, and we're having a humongous amount of money being invested in artificial intelligence, machine learning. We're talking about the Tesla plant, where the goal there is to continue to add more, you know, hire more robots than people. People are still very good at things, but there's a point in time where if you want to make this thing cheaply and be competitive in the marketplace, then you need to probably use robots. And the concern, of course, is, you know, what happens when you start replacing more and more jobs with robotics and automation? And this has been a thing that, you know, ever since, you know, somebody developed a better flint that saved time, they're like, well, you know, Ugg over there likes to chew on the leather. You know, why are you replacing him with your flints? This is not cool, dude. And what's he going to do? And it's like, I think Ugg will find a job, you know. And we've had that continuously. That was a big thing in the 1700s and the 1800s was with, you know, automation machines that could build other things. That was when it first happened, was like, man, like I have a machine press that can stamp out things. I don't need a tinsmith to cut these things with his shears and stuff. It's been the, but now we're at this point where we talk about Moore's law and accelerating change. The idea is the rate of change may all of a sudden go through a huge thing where in a couple decades time, you know, I could be as a writer competing with artificial intelligence for writing books. I've watched right now, you know, I've been following like computer narration for books, and it's scary good.
Like voice synthesizing.
Yeah. So that's sort of the starting point to say, hey, you know, we can say, you know, part of me is like, yeah, I've made arguments like we've always adapted. We've been very good at adapting. And I think that in a very huge economy, AI economy, there's going to be more jobs for people than there are people because of ways to do it. But, you know, the William Gibson had the comment, like, you know, the future's here, but it's unevenly distributed. And I think that's one of the other side of it is like, yes, ideally, but in practice, maybe not. I'll just start it from there.
So what's the question? The question is, what does it look like in the future in terms of UBI, Universal Basic Income, I think is a really interesting idea. There are because it has champions on complete opposite sides of the political mm-hmm. spectrum. You have futurists who say it's so obvious that robots are going to be better at doing just about everything than us that we're all going to be unemployed. So we all need to be able to eat. So we should all have this universal basic income. And, you know, maybe they're on the far left and they feel like everyone's entitled to a safety net. But on the flip side, on the far, far right, you also have supporters of universal basic income because what we have right now is a patchwork of various plans that involve the government telling you, you have to want this kind of healthcare. You have to want this kind of, you know, you have to do this type of job for minimum wage. If you want to check, you have to do whatever. And it's very expensive. And on the right, they say there are people who say, hey, if you just wipe out all those programs and instead just write a check to every single living person, then they could spend the money however they want according to their interests. If they want to eat ramen, take the remainder of that to take premium online courses to better themselves so that they can, you know, develop the next flying robotic fish, then that's their choice because that's their dream and that's their money to spend. So to me, that's one of the things that's fascinating about it is how politically agnostic the movement for it seems to be.
Absolutely. It's you get libertarians, socialists, conservatives, people in different spectrums are all saying maybe we're going to need this. I have concerns. And we could start with the argument like we already, like Brian pointed out, we already do every modern economy, every modern government does forms of this. Public education. Every person gets access to public education for the first up until you're 18 years old. And so we say we have a minimum basic educational thing that we give to people. Now, you can see kind of the concerns that I have with like, you know, an NBI is that what we decided to do, you know, like back in the 80s and 90s, we said, let's make higher education cheaper. And the way we decided to make it cheaper was not by actually making it cheaper, but by decreasing the interest rates on student loans and the penalties for that. So we made student loans much more easy to get. And so instead of incentivizing making education cheaper, we just made it so anybody could just get access to a student loan. And what happened there was if you look at the cost, like the two biggest increasing costs are healthcare and education, higher education levels, right? And healthcare, you can argue that you get way more services now than you did before, but there's our big points. It's still crazy expensive what it should be. But with education is that it didn't increase the instructor ratio. The quality of education did not improve. The quality of education, you had more, not increase in instructors, but more middle managers, other people. You look at camp. I'd walk into some of these campuses and I'd see how they'd changed over 10, 15 years. I'm like, this is like the most amazing corporate campus I've seen in the world. And this is actually kind of ridiculous because once the cost of getting a loan went down, students like, I'll pay more. Like, oh, they just raised the tuition rate $10,000. What does it matter? I can put that cost, that payoff into the future. And now you have people campaigning on the idea of we're going to forgive all student debt. We're going to forgive this debt because, you know, people have huge amounts of debt. Like, why did this happen? Well, the cost of education just went tremendously high. And even though there's these wonderful opportunities out there, like, you know, I'm a big fan of Udemy and these other online courses, it's hard to get jobs with those. It's still hard to apply those. And my point is like, you can have MBI, but what will it buy you? You know, we've seen that, you know, if you all of a sudden everybody gets this minimum basic income, things will get more expensive. We've seen that before. Then the things we're going to want, you know, in San Francisco, you know, $100,000 is considered low income.
Mm-hmm.
And so in MBI, you're not going to be able to live in San Francisco. You're not going to be able to, and that's the thing we have to think about is that, you know, we could say, well, you should move, but people don't want to be told that.
Yeah. I think of it, man, I would love to see if somebody has done a large scale study over the economy of, you remember Second Life? That's what, a decade mm-hmm. ago now? So, yeah. Second Life kind of was a natural experiment in what I would imagine universal minimum basic income would look like, because you could get around. You had no restrictions on travel. You could get property. Yeah, there's no restrictions on that. You could manufacture pretty much anything you could build. But then what people wanted to spend real dollar money on was these skills of artisans. It's like, I don't want a sword. I want that badass looking katana. I want the one that also has the so-and-so animation. And I feel like, you know, you could make a case that, you know, all of Second Life was what happens when the whole world becomes artists of some variety, whether they're manufacturing narratives for other people to do, whether they're manufacturing, oh, I'm building my perfect dream home and I can't wait to have a party to go over that. Nobody in Second Life, except for some people who maybe were running public events with the intention of charging real ticket prices or whatever. But again, that's art too. I think it was Teller that once told me, anything that's not feeding your family is art. Anything that's not keeping you alive is art. And then so I don't know. I could picture a world where we get into that. And one of the things about art, once everybody's doing art, is you – a nasty side effect of having freedom, and in this case I'm talking about economic freedom, is that you have to watch somebody spend their money, their time, their energy doing something that you would never do yourself and that you maybe disagree with philosophically. And the question is, you know, essentially the case for, you know, against taxation is, you know, if you don't pay your taxes, sooner or later someone shows up with a gun and will threaten to kill you or lock you in a box unless you give money. And so if you take all that money and then that money gets spent in a way that you, on a deeply spiritual or emotional level, disagree with, then you have a case to say, hey, this money was taken with, you know, against my will and spent on something that I absolutely disagree with. And, you know, that's part of the situation when people, you know, whether it's, you know, there are some people who favor government funded abstinence programs versus contraception, and you get into all kinds of tricky stuff. All I'm saying is that there's going to be a lot of sticky issues if we ever hit a UBI place.
I agree, and I guess the one I keep coming back to is that we can imagine what would be an ideal, and one is we can imagine what would be an ideal income now. You know, we can imagine this is what would be ideal. It's hard to know what's, but I could imagine what an ideal income would have been in 1980, and that didn't account for cell phone. It didn't account for internet access. It didn't account for Netflix. It didn't account for the idea that the average person in today eats out, prepares fewer meals than they did in 1980. And the quality of food that many people use has increased. There are all these things that we just didn't even conceive of then. And then so if you try to price that in, it gets hard. But if we have this super exponentially growing economy because AI is solving all those problems, that's not as much as a problem. But the big problem I think keeps coming back to me with a basic income promise is real estate, where you're going to live. You know, if I want to live in, you know, in Texas right now or Colorado, my income that I make now will go way farther than it does in LA. I make this choice to live in LA, and you hear these people complaining about problems in San Francisco. It's too expensive to live. You know, Seattle's the same. You have these housing crises, which are caused, we'll say there are multi-factors to that. And many times it's, you know, we have so many restrictions on what you can build. It only makes sense to make, you know, these, you know, apartment mansions, and nobody wants to do middle income housing there. And then, but anyhow, point is, my problem with the minimum basic income that I haven't heard an answer to, or universal basic income, I haven't heard an answer to is, cause I don't think it can answer, is how do I get to live in the place where I want to live? And the answer is you don't.
Correct. And man, I don't even really have either a solution or much of an opinion on that side. I do know that on the flip side, one of the arguments is that I think is the weakest argument against it is, oh, but if everyone has their bills covered, what's to stop them from just sitting around and playing video games all day? And the answer is, of course, nothing. But we also know that in the 1800s, in the 19th century, the major scientific advancements were conducted by men of leisure who were in a position that they did not have to work, but instead they were hungry for the prestige of being somebody who had, you know, tallied up the right number of petals on this peculiar type of lily or whatever. And the one of the thoughts would be that if you're not worried about keeping food on the table, what important gifts to humanity sit locked up in people who are busy, you know, not, you know, trying to put food on the table?
Part-time.
I take the opposite approach on that, because men of leisure going back to the ancient Greeks have been the ones thinking about these things. And the largest step change we had was the age of industrialization, when the middle class is great. Now you need to put this to use. And you look at how advances in optics driven by industrial revolution, how advances in tools from necessity drove that. And there are numerous examples. And again, it's going to be my polemical point of view. And I'm not going to say therefore fact, but we've seen examples of one of the founders of BlackBerry decided he was going to bring the best, you know, physicists in the world and create this university and this campus in Canada where they're going to like try to solve the big physics problems. And you look at the actual rate of publishing rate of these guys once they didn't have to worry about this income, declined precipitously. I worked with somebody who was a heavy output, heavy thinker. Once their income was taken care of, their output dropped tremendously. And it's certainly, we say, like, look at all these things these men of leisure did. Like, yeah, they were the ones that formed societies and did it. But once the Industrial Revolution happened, once there was a job to create these things, patents and everything that started happening just exploded once it became a job.
That's interesting. You're saying that that the comfort, as if all of humanity is guaranteed some level of comfort, that will potentially, or it runs the risk of eating away at the same drive that has made it so productive?
If somebody's personal choice is fine. I guess mine is more to the argument of saying that, like, hey, when we had all these men of leisure, look what they created. I'm like, well, we've had men of leisure for thousands of years. We've had a class. What changed? Why did we have this scientific revolution? And I would argue it was the Industrial Revolution that drove that. It was all of a sudden there was a way to make money and profit from this. That's my argument, is to say that, no, like, the biggest change was all of a sudden the applying some of this theoretical and testing it and whatever. Once you had the mechanisms of industry, that's when the real revolution took off, because there were people thinking about, you know, similar thoughts that Thomas Jefferson had 1,000 years before and before and before and before. And just, you know, but, you know, some of Jefferson's biggest contributions besides political theory, though, was industrial theory. And I guess what I'm saying is it was the industrialization was really the point at which things took off, because I've heard that, like, well, these guys came up with great theories. Like, yeah, so did the ancient Greeks. What changed that all of a sudden brought us the day we have today?
So I would love to hear Bryce's general take on all this, because you're younger than us.
I think for me, whether it's talking about MBI or UBI or even things like minimum wage increase, is partially because – in general, wages have not been following with inflation and with the economy growing, and you're seeing a larger disparity of wealth between the top end earners and the bottom end earners. I think whether it's a minimum income, whether it is a higher minimum wage, I think a lot of it is founded by this issue of this disparity in wealth and the fact that people are being priced out of, like we were talking about San Francisco, right? If San Francisco is too expensive to live in, but it's still a society and a community that needs lower end jobs. But if you are working 40 hours a week in San Francisco and you can't even afford to live in the city, at some point you are either, it is becoming detrimental for you to work there, or you are going to have to work somewhere else, and you are creating a problem. You're creating a problem there where the people who need to be in service positions there can't afford to live there, can't afford to live around there. And how do you solve that?
I have a suggestion.
Okay, go. Yeah.
Okay.
Work somewhere else until they raise the weight. It's like right now there's a trucking crisis. They say this, they're having trouble finding truck drivers. I do not understand the complexity of the situation. So my simple explanation may be totally wrong. pay more. You know, and that's one of the things is that, like, you have a problem. There are people willing to do the job at a lower rate. And that's one of the problems. You get into a city like San Francisco, and if you're doing a lower paying job, you're competing with somebody who might be totally comfortable living with five other people in an apartment. And that's, you know, gets into the issue of, like, you know, what should a job pay? And it's like, no, I'm a market guy, you know, what the market will bear.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I know there was an article that was floating around a week or two ago that was like, if you were working, you know, a minimum wage job for 40 hours a week in these various cities, here's what you would make. And it would not be enough to sustain a single person or a family. And that's, there are facets to that. But I think in general, if you were working 40 hours a week, you should be able to live and eat and provide for yourself and have health care. And
well, what does should mean? What does should mean?
What does should mean?
Yeah. I mean, I guess what
I think if you're putting in your time to help society, I don't know how to solve for should for you, but
there's should in a legal sense, which is it is the responsibility of the government to guarantee that that is the case. And then there's should in mm-hmm. that the sense of what we would all hope would be the way for it to be.
I don't know what should is, but I think that if you're putting in 40 hours a week into society, society should give back to you payment and enough resources to sustain yourself. That is the balance that we've come up with. 40, 40, 40.
If I'm hearing Andrew correctly, I think what he's saying is that there are mm-hmm. plenty of places where that is the case. And mm-hmm. if you're in a city where that's not the case, then, you know,
everybody should leave that city.
I'll say, like, okay, when I was 15, my first job, I was 15 years old. Okay. I worked at this movie theater. It was this second run movie theater. I should not have been paid a living wage to work there. Should not have. I was not worth a living wage. I was a good employee, and I'd work sometimes 20 hours. But if I worked 40 hours a week at 15 years old, and I was doing a job that some adults did, whatever, that would have been ridiculous for them to try to pay me enough to have my own apartment and car at 15 years old, because it just would have been silly. And even if I had that same, I worked at a magic shop when I was 18, you know, like 18 years old, should that magic shop have if they had to pay me that shop would never have existed. I was living at home, so I didn't have to worry about rent. You know, I used my parents' car. I could do that job. Had they had to pay me a living wage, that shop would not exist. That job would not existed. I would have been outside the workforce like many people are today. Like, I would hire somebody in a heartbeat if it were easier to hire somebody in California. But if I have to hire somebody right now, my responsibilities and burdens I have to pay, which means there are people I know who would love to be able to work part time or whatever, work with somebody like this. But that cost, who are willing to say, like, OK, I don't need you to pay me a full income to support a family, whatever, but I would like to make some extra money a week. But I'm too cheap to hire somebody because that cost is too high. Therefore, there's somebody sitting there going who does not have that opportunity.
Well, okay, but I'm not talking about 15 year olds or part timers. I'm talking about someone who's able to find 40 hours of work a week.
So, but for 20, you make it at 20 hours to once somebody works for me 40 hours. I mean, where do you decide that change happens? So,
I mean,
when does that hour of work become worth more?
I mean, I definitely was working 40-hour weeks over the summer when I was 17, and even more. You know, it would dip into overtime territory and all that. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess I just don't know then for you guys what someone's input into society should be such that they are able to survive.
I think that's one of the things
that input into society. How do you define that?
Generally work.
So this is one of the things that attracts me to the idea of universal basic income, is because then at that point, I don't care what you do with your time or how hard you work or whatever, because minimum wage is problematic in that, let's say you set it let's say it's $20 an hour is the universal minimum wage. Then if I'm going to spend $20 an hour, I will never hire somebody who's not extremely already experienced and talented. I will never give a chance for anyone to apprentice or learn because I simply couldn't afford to. Whereas if it was a UBI thing, and then, you know, it's like, hey, I want to learn to be a editor producer. It's like, oh, great. Well, why don't you show up and we'll buy your beers? And it's like, that's a good deal to me. I get to learn. I get some free beers. And after all, you know, I've got my universal basic income to cover my housing, my clothing, my, you know, that kind of stuff. Or at least that's the appeal to it.
Can I bring up an interesting point about that?
Sure.
There are a number of jobs that, like, working for politicians, media in New York City, and like acting, that if you look at the average income of the average income of the parents of people who are successful is way higher. If you want to go intern or work for a politician, you better have wealthy parents. You know, you look at categorically across the board, there are a number of jobs that are outside of the average person's whatever, and you find out that it's children of wealthy get to do this because their parents say, yeah, we'll pay for you to go spend a, you know, summer in New York and go work for here, or we'll pay for you to go in DC and do this. Or actors, like number of actors you find out who actually come from very wealthy families, because to be able to be out here for several years and to be able to do castings every day, be have the availability, get constantly update your headshots, whatever, it is not a poor person's game.
Well, and plus also, like, you know, it doesn't sound like it's work, but part of the job is going to all the parties and find yourself, you know, standing next to the screenwriter to that movie for 10 minutes and having the right conversation to where you swap digits or whatever.
I mean, yes to all of that, but I think that is – that doesn't help someone if they're a dishwasher.
I understand to say that the problem is, as we say, if you have somebody who is on one end, is you say, okay, do we have like, if your job is in competition with a robot that a month later somebody comes up with a dishwashing robot that costs a restaurant $30 a month to use, that's a problem area. And if you're in an industry, or if you're in a job where it does not pay very much, like, one of my answers, like San Francisco, part of the problem in San Francisco is there are still people willing to do those jobs. And that's the problem. Is it the wages won't go up because people are willing to do the jobs? And you can say, okay, well, we'll raise the rates. We've had cities where they increase minimum wage, and then you want actual overall employment declines. And that's the tricky part of it, because some of these restaurants are operating on 4 or 5% margins and stuff. And it erases that. And it doesn't mean, like, therefore everything's right or whatever.
But if they're bad jobs that aren't able to sustain people, and they're not able to keep those positions filled.
If you look at when San Francisco raised minimum wage, number of places closed, like the number of jobs decreased. And so there were more people you raised minimum wage, more people became unemployed. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the problem in minimum wage. When you raise those in places, is unemployment increases, because that restaurant says, we hired 5 people. Now we can only hire 3. And you might say those 3 jobs get paid better, but then there are 2 people who didn't have a job. And again, I'd say those are some of the externalities. I would say my starting solution is one approach is, like, let's just subsidize people because they're not going to be able to be part of the workforce, whatever, which we're going to do in some form or other. But the other one I'd like to see more effort towards is skills training, job training, these things. How do you help somebody step up the ladder to go from being a liability to being somebody who contributes? You know, and I have conversations, so many people who are unaware. I sit there with Uber drivers and explain about, like, oh, you know, you got this degree from this other country. You know, if you take these courses here, that helps you do this. They didn't know this. I explain a lot of, you know, every week I'm explaining to somebody, like, oh yeah, here's, you can get these skills. You know, your public library has these things. How much have you done with community college? No idea that there are these resources out there, and they're not even as well developed as they could be.
Well, and then I guess that's one of those things where it's like, let's say even if they had the interest, then they have the complication of yeah, but I'm busy driving Uber 40, 50 hours a week, so I don't have the time to better myself or whatever. And you know, then of course it's, you know, you get into, like, well, you could listen to audio entertainment, you know, or audio educational stuff.
Did somebody say Bay Area wealth inequality?
Whoa, hey. Our resident expert in the Bay Area wealth inequality joining us live is correspondent Justin Robert Young.
Hi guys. I literally just walked in the door. But I caught a little bit of the conversation before I came on here.
What you missed was Andrew said, I want to pick the least divisive subject we've ever had on Weird Things. What say we talk about universal basic income versus the minimum wage in an age where robots take over everything?
You know, it's funny because I wonder if you guys started from the same topic that there's, I guess, a new a paper out about how there's a group of economists that say that we are really not prepared for the economic fallout of full the rise of the machines. And I think that a lot of the questions that we're having now, specifically about minimum wage, are really going to seem kind of frozen in ember in about 5 years. Like, you're already seeing a lot of the kind of minimum wage jobs be mechanized. And whether it makes this conversation even more acute, which I think is quite possible, that we're going to see more of an argument for, well, then that's the reason why we need to guarantee things at this level, or we need to raise what our guarantees are from a governmental perspective. But man, part of me thinks, and this might be just ready for the freezing cold takes archive in a few years, but I do kind of feel like universal basic income is going to be the argument of our upcoming epoch, however we want to define it.
Just to bring you up to speed, you know, UBI over minimum wage debates, minimum wage and living wages are going to be constantly shifting targets. No matter where you are, no matter what area you're in, there's going to be pressure to make it higher or lower, because what you have is you have everybody except for the person making the wage weighing in on how much they think that person needs. It feels like nothing will shift. And maybe it's the exact same problem with universal basic income, because then it becomes like, well, what is, you know, enough for the universal basic income?
Well, you know, I think the big tricky thing with UBI is you got to figure out when to flip that switch, and you kind of don't want to flip it too early. And every second that we do it too late will be something that is very painful and will shift our political landscape. Because if that consortium of economists is right on, and all of a sudden in the next 3 years, we're like, oh no, wait, we're facing serious unemployment. Like, our unemployment numbers are being affected by how many robots are able to take these jobs. Then all of a sudden we're going to have, this is going to be like, nothing turns political conversation like the economy. Nothing turns nothing turns it more intense.
I want to address, and I just want to acknowledge the comment section we're reading there. I want to say that the argument, like, if they could get a restaurant, if they could have three people instead of five, they would have moved to three anyways. But then they find out they can't function with three people and service to clients, and they go out of business. Happens in LA all the time. Business go out, and that's been in minimum. When they raise minimum wages, you see that happen. I was just in Australia. Somebody brought up Australia, like, hey, we pay higher here, whatever. Service sucked. There was no tableside service. It was a totally different – people were nice. It was a totally different standard that I was used to in an American restaurant. I'm like, no, you go up to the counter and order your food. I'm like, a fast food place? I'm like, are you kidding me? And I was like, everywhere. I loved that people loved this, but it was – I could see the effects of the fact that, like, I couldn't – that I'm like, it was a different level of service, you know?
Yeah, you could tell nobody's chasing that extra 5% tip.
Yeah,
because
cared.
Tipping,
you know, like,
there's no tipping culture.
I take care of people. So that was like – and that's a choice, and that's like, listen, like, I don't like, but I was like, man, like, I noticed, like, yeah, there's lots of places on tables, but like, a lot of them didn't, places you expected to. And so that was the difference, is that in here we can underpay somebody and they come to your table and there's a trade-off. And Bryce's concern is a very, very valid concern. And Bryce, I don't want you to feel like, I get your point. It's like, you know, if I have a skill or I have this or whatever, like, why should I feel like I'm not valued? You know, why should somebody suffer or whatever? And how do you prevent people from, you know, being excluded, or what do you do there? And I don't know where the responsibility of taking care of that falls. I think that's kind of the argument kind of comes down to. Is it responsible for, you know, the government, a person, or is it the person their own responsibility? Is it their employer? Is the government, you know? But I don't know.
Well, and these are all the questions that I think They become so passionate, because obviously you are talking about a segment of the population that, as Bryce pointed out, is looking, you know, the greatest gift that the internet gave us. And social media, I think, is the beating heart of it. It is the pulse of it, is the interconnection instantaneously into other people's worlds. And so now never has a widening wealth gap seemed more in your face than when you can watch and see, you know, just from news stories to Elon Musk's Instagram, what the difference between my life and somebody else's life is.
Right.
Combine that with the fact that, you know, there are these economic challenges that now the fear is, or the empathy on one side is, well, look at this pain. We are watching this pain happen in front of us. And the libertarian kind of fear is always, all right, well, where's this line drawn? Because at some point, every law is going to have unintended consequences. And you do kind of have to talk about people who are in minimum wage jobs that are, you know, either close to the beginning of their careers and their teens, because that's predominantly who fills these kinds of gigs. And should we be, is a raise in the minimum wage the best way for us to make sure that a father and mother of three are able to live in the place where they work? Or is the unintended consequence that now all of a sudden 15-year-old or 16-year-olds at the beginning of the labor market are now unhirable? Like, you never just, you can't go close to them.
Yeah, I guess that's a whole other question, is at what age do you start getting the UBI? Is it from birth and then you get to spend it on whatever kind of school you want? But then you get into that place where there are people against the idea of having school choice. Whereas like in Belgium, you know, the money is attached to the kid and you can go to whatever school you want. And as a result, you get schools that specialize in different things. And another side effect is schools compete, and some of them compete on amenities, other compete on reputations of having excellent academics and test scores and placement in higher education and so on.
You know, and then you have like healthcare in Singapore. You know, you're born, you get a medical savings account, they give you X amount of money, and then you make choices on what you use, which is, you know, another argument for, like, you know, where these things work. I guess my part of what my concern is that some of the problems that people are facing won't be solved by that, like housing prices in San Francisco. You know, UBI will not solve that problem. You know, living in big cities, you know, it will not solve the fact that, hey, I went to go live in San Francisco. Guess what? There's only X number of houses there. Rich people are going to be the ones to buy those.
And that's actually a really good point, because there's no number you could set the UBI at that will suddenly cause it to be affordable to live in San Francisco. If everybody got $100,000 a year, the population of Scam Francisco would not change. It would be exactly the same demographic and everything.
Well, here's all I know about the Bay Area specifically, is I walk around every day and I see a lot of buildings that could be a lot of housing, and they are not. And there are a lot of very good reasons. And these, if we really want to drill down on it, they span the gamut. Find your political persuasion, and I can show you a legitimate problem with the Bay Area housing market, be it over-governmental regulation, predatory landlords that are kicking people out. Like, there is something for everybody. It is a legitimate problem buffet where everyone can go home happy. But this is a confluence of a lot of problems. And I don't think, if anybody wants to kind of make it into a one-dimensional argument of, oh, it's the tech companies, oh, it's the plutocrats, or oh, it's just these crappy housing laws, it's like, you want to know what? The answer is yes, you're right. And everybody's too busy pointing their fingers at each other to actually try to come up with any kind of real solution, IMO.
So one of the things we talked about at the very top of this before you showed up, Justin, is that UBI is such an interesting character in that it has supporters, very strong supporters, on all different sides of the political spectrum. Do you feel like, you know, on the libertarian side, oftentimes it's presented as a replacement to all of these social norm crafting government programs that say, no, we want society to look like this, so we're going to incentivize it by only giving, you know, money if you could prove that you're looking for a dishwashing job or something?
Man, I can't remember who it was, but I remember reading an anecdote about when I think it was Alex Rodriguez, the baseball player, was dating this like tech titan, right? Some lady from Silicon Valley that had made a lot of her own money. And so they were this kind of power couple for a hot minute.
Was her name Brianna Young?
It was not Brianna Young, no. Although she certainly has all kinds of experience in many different areas. There's like an anecdote from their relationship that like this is how we're kind of different. I think it was Sergey Brin's ex-wife, the 23andMe lady. And he was like, oh, you wanted to buy a baseball team or something like that. And she was like, wow, I mean, if you look at the rise of esports in 25 years, this is going to be a failing property. I would short your investment in this baseball team. And it's like, yes, and there's probably going to be a lot of time when that is going to be profitable just because it is eventually going to become obsolete. And she might be right on a long enough timeline. I think that UBI is a fascinating political argument now, because I feel that the Elon Musks of the world, the libertarians of the world, are looking at this larger timeline.
Described himself as a socialist. Let's point that out.
Yes. He said, which I mean, I loved his definition. I'm a socialist because the real problem is trying to figure out how to avoid dangerous monopolies, which is just one of those things that, you know, he just gets a half stiffy when he repeats it at Silicon Valley parties with like super, super left leaning people. But effectively, I just feel like UBI is something where if you're a futurist, and for people who are also talking about the singularity and never dying and all this kind of stuff, that and dying on Mars, that UBI is something that I don't think is a 10 to 15 year problem. But when we get into it in a political sense, the, you know, political conversations are like McDonald's fries. Like they come and go in 2 year periods. So I feel like people who are talking about UBI as something to do now are talking about it on a fundamentally different way than I think the kind of conceptual futurist aim of it.
Well, I feel like we solved that one.
Totally.
You're welcome,
solved.
The world.
Just a quick, we had a question from the chat room. Somebody said, what was the point of a restaurant or goal of a restaurant in a business? It's the same profit. The goal is profit. It's not to cheat, to steal or whatever, unless it's profitable to do that and you can get away with it. The goal is profit. Profit is efficiencies. You find inefficiencies, you exploit them, take advantage of them, and you make profit. That's generally the goal. As it should be. It's the same as a biological system. What is your goal? To survive, to have enough resources to continue to survive. You know, it's I don't see a big difference between, you know, understanding how economics works or biology. It's all related. And if you want it, there's a book by Matt Ridley, Evolution of Everything, which goes into sort of this thing, understanding how one system applies to another. There you go.
Anyhow, yeah.
Problem solved. It's good.
Speaking of minimum basic income, we'd like to have some for this show.
Yes.
So if you head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings, you can kick in some money. If you think that that this conversation was worth the buck, we would love to have it. So you also get all kinds of other benefits like the After Things podcast, your very own RSS feed, the smug superiority that comes from somebody who knows that you contributed towards a project, 9 years in the making? 9 years we've been doing this now? Buy us a coffee.
Yeah.
Except only one of us drinks coffee.
Wait, is that true?
I drink coffee. I mean, I don't think I've ever had a coffee with either of you.
Oh, well, I mean,
Brian, you drink coffee?
Yeah. When that's the only choice.
I've never drank like a whole cup of coffee in my life.
Really? Oh no. Yeah, I'll rock a cup of the black stuff.
It's usually soda, though.
Oh yeah, yeah, it is usually. Yeah.
9 times 9. Yeah. Both of you, I think would be delighted to wake up with a nice crisp soda in the morning, preferred to coffee. Mm.
That's true.
Yeah.
You know
sounds
why?
Good.
Because
yeah.
because it's like soda has never once turned around and go and said, "Ha ha, I'm physically injuring you for drinking me the wrong way." With the way a coffee will.
That's a fair point. If it weren't for the fact that I am, even at my advanced age, I'm incapable of not burning my mouth at all times. Like, I can't. I know it's too hot. Sometimes I'll say it out loud, this is too hot, and I'll still eat it.
Yeah.
Like, I just can't stop. So.
Do we want to move on to picks?
Sure.
I think we've.
then we go into after things. Sound good?
Right? Yeah. That sounds great. You know what? I guess my pick is I'm going to continue the pick that I believe I puck right before I left. I think I said I was rereading the Gentleman Bastard series by Scott Lynch, starting with The Lies of Locke and Lamora. Once I was on the cruise ship, I listened to Red Seas Under Red Skies, which is all about the two of the main characters learning how to be pirates and how you don't mess around with the sea because the sea will gobble you up and you'll die. And that was fun to experience surrounded by ocean where I could be gobbled up by the ocean and die. And now I'm on to The Republic of Thieves. Man, is it great. I wish my daughter was just a little bit older and more comfortable with foul language because there's cursing left and right, but there's virtually no tawdry sex. A lot of killing, a lot of stabbing, murdering and whatnot. And of course, the main characters are thieves. But it's a blast. It's a blast. It's my favorite book I've reread in a very long time.
It's a ripping yarn, it sounds like.
Yeah. So it's a real Aussie ripper summer.
That's exactly a true thing. Well, I'm going to repeat my pick from last week because I think it really was a shame that Brian wasn't here for it because he's been probably the person that has championed this the most in my life. And I finally got around to pulling the trigger on listening to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History.
Oh, no. I thought for sure you were going to say Conspiracy by Ryan Holiday. But that's great that you're digging Hardcore History, man.
And so I listened to The King of Kings. I actually just wrapped it up when I was on the way here. It is a trilogy of expansive podcasts. I mean, I don't think any one of these episodes comes in at under 2.5 hours. And the final one is like a double episode that's damn near 5. But man, you know, look, it is such a rad way of, putting everything together. He's a master storyteller. The audio is fantastic. So, it really illustrated to me what the top end of that genre is because man, there's a reason why he's the king of it.
Yeah. So do you think, cause his whole business model, maybe this is something we could talk about in the future after things, his whole thing is, you know, he keeps putting them out for free, but once they age out, you know, they're a buck an episode and the back catalog, you know, are you seduced to the point where you feel like spending a little bit of cash for some of the previous ones? Because
certainly so. Although I even noticed myself, he has such a distinct speaking style that I do in the One Mic podcast. I noticed myself doing the Dan Carlin kind of like lilt. Like, he has this very distinctive, like, slow down, speed up kind of style where he talks very melodically. Now, I just want to say, when you think about how Dan Carlin talks, you almost think, well, he slows down. But after all, he can go faster.
And yet, there are times he can speak with so much intensity, with percussive power that makes you understand what it looks like for 60,000 gallons of blood to fill the open sea. I don't know about you, Justin, but when I picture that in a beautiful high-definition television in front of my face, it brings chills to my spine. It's like if Lady Gaga were live on the deck, dancing, covered in meat.
It's great, and also just him getting into the like the pronouncements of like old, you know, the old historians. Like he'll just read them word for word, but like in his big percussive tones. It's great. Look, I know that when I first started talking about it last week, Andrew, anything that you would worry, now having gotten 3 episodes into it, anything that you would worry that this is any if there is a political slant to it, it is like mired in the old world of yes, there is a political slant. He kind of suspects and is skeptical of the Grecian telling of the great wars.
As you should be. Yeah.
So that's his political slant.
Yeah. Although he does have a companion podcast, Common Sense with Dan Carlin, which is really interesting. I think he took a pretty big break after Trump got elected because I think he's having a harder time figuring out exactly what he wants to say in such a chaotic time.
Bryce?
Oh, there was a game that came out recently. It was a remake of an old puzzle game from 2004, called Luminous, and the new game is Luminous Remastered. It's a really cool puzzle game. It's kind of like Tetris, but there are only two colors, and so you're dropping these blocks to make squares of colors, and as you play, it goes along to a rhythm, and the songs change as you play. It's really good. I know on the original game, I probably spent like 100 hours with it, so... that's on the Switch. It's only like $15. It's also on the other consoles, and it's on PC. I recommend it.
My daughter Josie got me on Lolo. Have you played Lolo?
What is Lolo?
It's another one of them app block kind of games. You have three colors, and you tap them once they become in clusters of at least three or more, and then they collapse into higher valued things, and you collect them all and then make it hit. It's got that stay alive mechanic. Reminded me of Threes or Drop Seven.
Oh, yeah. This one's a little bit more like Puyo Puyo Tetris, if you know that, or like it's kind of got a Tetris vibe where as the songs change, you see there's a line here that travels across the playfield in time with the music. So like across two measures usually. And so as you're setting up blocks that are ready to be counted, when the timeline bar here goes over it, that's when it scores it. So you have a rhythm element where you are trying to get these ready to score blocks together and bigger and build on it before they get hit. So you get score bonuses and stuff. It's really cool. And this has all the licensed music from the original game from 2004, including really great house music from this Japanese producer. Who went by Mondo Grosso, and so all those like iconic sort of songs are still in there. So, Luminous Remastered.
All right, Smug Alert, Smug Alert. We have a Smug Alert here. Okay, I'm gonna make a pick, and I'm gonna qualify this pick by saying, every now and then when I have time, I go to some of these kind of crazy small conferences where it's like 12 or 14 people, and you get a reading list when you go there. And the conference might be like on, 19th century socialism, and, reading the works of a guy like Kropotkin or whatever. And so, and it's very interesting. The last one I went to was on Malthus, and it was very interesting because it was Malthus's point of view, defenders of Malthus and whatnot. Thomas Malthus is the guy that basically said, hey, we're going to overpopulate and run out of food, kind of generalization there, maybe not being totally charitable to his point of view on that point. Is I like going to these things because I have to read different points of view on stuff. And the downside is when you read and you go outside your team and you say, let me go read that team. I'm going to go read the other team's literature on this. Not have somebody on my team tell me what the other team said, because that's really the problem. If you just all you're on and conservative websites listening to conservatives tell you what liberals think, you won't really know what liberals think. You'll know what conservatives think liberals think. And the same goes for liberals and vice versa. Economics is a great example of that. A lot of people have economic theories because, one, we have this, like, the topic of common sense got brought up, and people are like, well, most people don't have it. Like, maybe I don't have it. I don't know. And we're very easy. Like, I bring up critical thinking, like, yeah, people need more. Like, I think I need more. I'll start with me needing more, and then I'll get into maybe other people do too. It is very, 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 very helpful to understand the other points of view as the other people said this. When I'm a non-believer, I read the Book of Mormon. I converted, did a sin, but I tried to read, works and other, translated works and other things like, Muslim, whatever, things like this. But I've tried to read these things. So I want to understand, what did they say? How did they say this? Because I want to know. And I think that applies to economics. And I advocate, like, read stuff, people advocating theories. But if you read something that's critical of a different economic theory, go read what they said, because there are some very popular works out there that are very controversial in other groups, because, like, no, that's not what was said at all. It was taken out of context. So I'm going to make a suggestion for something, two suggestions. One is, if you want to watch something kind of not recent, but relatively recent comparatively, is The Commanding Heights. Was a PBS documentary about kind of the war between socialism and capitalism in the 20th century. You've got people like Bill Clinton commenting on it. It's a very, very, very good overview of what happened, or an explanation of, you know, why did, you know, Western Western market systems succeed while socialist ones not? It's an explanation for that. And I'm also in the same vein, if you want to go further back, Free to Choose. Milton Friedman wrote a book and a series of videos. They're old videos, but I think you can find them on YouTube. Hear Milton Friedman explain his points of view on these things. And he's a guy that did not like the idea of a UBI, but he said, if you're going to do one, this is how you would make it work. He was very good at going, no, it's a horrible idea. I'll tell you how to make the best version of this, whatever. But there's actually a series of videos, Free to Choose, you can watch. Milton Friedman and his wife, Rose, she often, like, I'm guilty of not giving Rose enough credit. She contributed considerably to the work of Milton Friedman. She was an amazing person unto herself.
Yeah, I'm gonna bet that they're all on YouTube. I know that at some point I had gotten bootlegs of the DVDs to watch. And in 1990, it was originally out, I want to say like 79 or 80, but then they revisited it in 1990 with introductions by the likes of like Arnold Schwarzenegger, and then they would do debates afterwards. Whether or not you, and it is amazing to see a completely irony-free, impassioned defense of sweatshops. Like, he's in a sweatshop explaining how it's so important, because however you feel about these hot, sweaty conditions or whatever, this is what it meant to the person who got there, who built the skills, who later went on to do blah, 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 blah. And when you remove this stepping stone, you make it harder for people to climb out of poverty. And again, you know, that's not to say everything is 100% right, but definitely, definitely, I think you're right. Listen to the other side on all those issues.
Yeah, it just and you can come out of it going, no, I still have a fundamental problem with the way those things work. I have a fundamental problem with markets, because you could say, like, there may be an invisible hand, but it takes too long to react and we need to intervene in a, you know, shorter term. Just it's so much more helpful when I have discussions with people when they at least have that bedrock of knowing what those other arguments are, because often you get frustrated going, well, you know, like, we had to hear, like, what's the purpose? Well, it's purpose is profit. You know, if I'm an investor giving my money to a company, I want a return on my investment, you know?
Well, but there's also, you know, the case could be made that there's different types of currency to get paid back in. You get paid back in the feeling of goodwill and.
Oh yeah. For sure. But like, if you're a lot of like we talk about corporate America, you're talking about pension funds for teachers that are invested in there and this stuff. And we lose sight of, like, we think of these, you know, we go to the 19th century caricature of some fat guy with a cigar. And it's like, well, no, do you contribute to a retirement fund? That's somebody managing that is investing in Tesla and other companies like this. And they're asking for these high rates of return. And we forget how connected we are into these systems. And so anyhow, Free to Choose is a great explanation from Milton Rose Friedman's point of view of this. OK, so it's like I'm not saying, like, therefore you all need to be this. It's like condescending, like, watch this or get into this. Then the discussion elevates, because then it's this, we're not repeating the same arguments we've had for 100 years.
So, yeah.
All right. It's been not really that weird. It's kind of, you know, it's been weird.
Nailed it.
Yeah. Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.